Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. On this month's Wonder Woman podcast.
And in the book, you can see fairies. We have fairies that protect the trees and the bog pools and lakes and stones.
I go bog hiking in Estonia's secret and rather magical landscape, a world away from the stag parties you'd usually expect in Tallinn. I also meet Dr. Guy Stevens, founder of the Maldives-based Manta Trust, who encourages us all to be citizen scientists simply by swimming with them.
It's like swimming with a flock of giant, birds underwater.
And I catch 5 minutes with my fellow wild sleeper, Robert McFarlane.
We entered the illegal sections of the catacomb labyrinth, and the labyrinth is full of these tight squeezes, which are absolutely terrifying.
Coming up, you two can pat like a pro with my hard-won travel hack, walk this way as I reveal the best long-distance paths in the world, and, with my wonderful podcast partners Rohan, talk the best travel gear for a life on the road. Finally, I'll be revealing this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month, the traveller lost in the history books. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, an audio travel magazine with me, Phoebe Smith, exploring off-the-beaten-track destinations, wild spaces, wildlife encounters, and the unsung heroes behind conservation efforts. Come wander with me. Welcome to the Wonder Woman podcast. I'm here in Tallinn in Estonia in the very hipster upcoming area called Telliskivi. And you can hear behind me some jazz musicians just rocked up, decided to play with a saxophone and bass here on a Saturday morning. People are out drinking their macchiatos and espressos and cortados. And this is outside of the old town, an up and coming gentrified area that used to be very industrial. But now it's all about drinking coffee, playing music, and home to more new startups than anywhere else in the city. Welcome to a side of Estonia you might not have been expecting. I had, of course, heard about Estonia before, and in particularly Tallinn, and shamefully written it off as a place for stag parties and football hooligans only, and certainly not a place for a Wonder Woman like me. But on doing a little research, I quickly found that there was much, much more to this place beyond the walls of the old town. This was a country where you could go bog walking for fun, more on that later, indulge in a beer-infused bath, again, more later, and where nature and health seemed to permeate into every facet of daily life. But first I, feeling a little sceptical, met local Eveline in the old town to see if she could convince me to change my preconceptions.
Tere, Eveline.
Tere, tere.
So I've just said hello to you in Estonian. What am I actually saying?
You are wishing health to me. Tere word means health, actually, but we have turned it into hello.
That sounds really a nice way of greeting someone. And you were saying that tere is also a way you say cheers when you're having a drink.
Yeah, we just put a case ending for the health, and then hello becomes a cheers word terviseks in Estonian.
And it seems that health, the natural world, the environment, I mean, we stood in Tallinn, the capital city, but I feel like health and the environment kind of is permeating into everything, into the food that we eat, into the words that you use. Would you say Estonians are very health conscious?
We are very health conscious. We can maybe feel that in earlier times, like, we didn't have so great possibilities to take care of ourselves so much, maybe. So that's why now, when everything is free and open, you can have time for yourself, and that feels good.
We wandered through the cobbled streets of the old town, which stands well preserved after escaping much of the bombings in World War II. It was here where, amid the medieval walls, grandeur of the Estonian palace, the Russian Orthodox Cathedral, German ambassador's residence, all of which sit side by side, that I got a real sense of Estonia's past. It has a tumultuous history, having been ruled by the Finnish,
the Nazis, Soviet Union, and now, finally, they are independent. How did they do it? The first way was by gathering together in choir groups, where they would hide subversive messages through songs seemingly about nature, before later using the gatherings to talk politics and strategy. The other was using nature's own resources to help protect the reinstatement of democracy, in this instance, a giant boulder, which is a landmark in the town.
It was a huge granite block that we used in order to keep the Soviet tanks away in 1991 when they wanted to hinder the TV and radio connection and they wanted to turn back the democracy development. We had free election in 1990 already. So we used that stone and big trucks and bulldozers to just stop them, the tanks, going to our parliament building and doing anything wrong, bad.
And now it stands as a testament to that. So nature again, really helping the Estonian people. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
I forgot to mention to you that the three most important things for Estonians or local people, if you ask them, they will tell you first that the most important thing for me is forest, so nature. And the second important thing is the rye bread, our national food, the dark bread, black bread. And the third important thing is internet. Wi-Fi.
Oh, I can definitely see where they're going with that one. Thank you very much, Eveline. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Going in search of the first two important things on Eveline's list, and thankfully leaving the latter one behind, I met up with Helen, who does walking tours to Estonia's famous bogland. We jumped in her van, and on the way, she told me a little about the bogs.
So Estonia's history starts 10,000 years ago when our last ice age ended. So when the ice left Estonia and it melted and scraped our landscape, made us hills and rivers and peninsulas, then it also left us lakes, like in the holes between the hills. So the bogs have been developing since then. So the oldest bogs we have are 10,000 years old. So the bogs are kind of wetlands, the last stage of a wetland that's growing full of peat moss. So in some of the bogs you'll see a lake in the middle. So it's an ancient lake that's been growing full of peat moss.
We arrived on the edge of Konu Sursu Bog, part of Kuvemar Nature Reserve, where Helen showed me a gateway to this rather magical area.
We are on the edge of the bog, actually. We are in the forest, and the pine trees are quite high here, about 10, 15 meters. And if you find a tree that is a little bit like crooked, then it's a holy tree or a special tree. So here you can see two trees leaning against each other.
Oh, yeah.
So we call it the gateway. So in the older times, people believed that if you go through the gateway, you can make a wish. You can wish for a superpower. And in the older times, of course, the superpower was to be as strong as a bear or fast as a wolf or something, or with a eyesight of an eagle. And nowadays, you can ask for anything, I think.
What would you ask for?
Good health. But I can assure you that I've done it for 4 years. And there are loads of gateways everywhere here. If you look around, you see the gateways everywhere. So if you go through 15 gateways in one hiking tour, you'll definitely get what you want. So in the end, so now I can send you through the gateway, and
yeah.
Please don't tell the wish.
I shouldn't really tell you my wish, but given I was about to walk on a bog, a very wet area that I'd always avoided over the years, it may have been something to do with keeping my feet dry. Thankfully, magic ran its course, and Helen presented me with a superpower, bog shoes. So we've been walking on boardwalks that were put here in 2011, thanks to EU funding, so that people can access these boglands. But we're going to step off them now, Helen, and we're putting on these special bog shoes. They look a little bit like snowshoes. What's the thinking behind them?
Well, actually, it's pure logic. If your body weight is on a wider surface, then it's easier to walk, especially when you walk on snow. So bog shoes are actually an ancient invention together with skis. So skis were for speed. Boat shoes were for comfort. And we are wearing these universal boat shoes that you can really use in the winter also. They have spikes underneath for ice. And actually, we can think that the boardwalks and boat shoes are for like our comfort. Actually, it's to protect the boat and this delicate nature. So we wouldn't make a trail here. So we spread our body weight a little bit wider, and then we won't hurt the nature.
That's such a satisfying sound, isn't it? The sound of the bog shoes squelching on the bog water.
It feels like if you think about a little kitten that is like purring on your lap and doing like scraping you a little bit.
That's exactly what it's like. And we've not walked that far off the boardwalk, but we've already come to some bog pools. And Maya the dog is really enjoying herself now that we're out here. Tell me a little bit about what you said before about how Estonia nearly lost the bogs because the Nazis, when they came, were sort of, you know, there's good and bad nature.
Yeah, even during the Nazis and the Soviets, they divided nature into two categories, the good nature and bad nature. And for example, wolves were really disliked because they were the enemies for our food resources. And so they had this quote that let's kill all the wolves, for example. So it was the same with other nature. Forest was good because it gave us wood for fire and building material. Fields were good, of course. You had to feed lots of people. But the bogs were bad because there was no point of the bogs. So there was this, for example, advertisement for Estonian National University that let's repair all the faults of nature. Let's try all the bogs and let's make them to fields and grow food on them. But nowadays scientists know that bogs accumulate CO2, and if you dig it out or dry it, then it releases twice as much. So it is actually a big, big hazard to our climate.
We spent the rest of the afternoon squelching around on the delicate bogland, thankfully keeping our feet dry, stopping to watch birds and then grabbing a bite to eat, with homemade black rye bread, of course, an Estonian tradition. When we did stop, Helen took some time to tell me about some of the mythology that surrounds this landscape.
So in Estonia, we still talk about mythological creatures because our folklore is really connected with nowadays, thanks to new writers who write about the old creatures and old religion. And in the bog, you can see fairies. We have fairies that protect the trees and the bog pools and lakes and stones. So we have legend for everything. So if you see a stone, don't climb on it. You need to know the purpose or the legend behind it. And here in the bog, we still talk about will-o'-wisps, the secret lights that light during the nighttime. It's the same story like with the sailors, that if you hear a woman crying in the middle of the night on the sea, don't follow the voice, you will die. So we have the same stories here in the bog. If you see or hear a woman crying, don't follow her, follow me, only me.
Unless the crying is me, because I've stepped wrong on a bog.
So when the guys hear you crying, they're not allowed to follow you.
As we headed back to Helen's van, ready to start our drive back to Tallinn, there was one more experience she wanted me to try first. Okay, so we've walked to the bog, we've walked over the bog in our bog shoes, and now we're going to swim in the bog. Tell me why we would do this, Helen, please.
I think this... actually, I don't know. But I think it's something to do with challenge, just to overcome yourself, the fear of cold water. In Estonia, maybe it doesn't get warmer than this, so we have to embrace everything we have right now.
Well, at least the sun's out. So without further ado, shall we head in? We're making our way towards the water now. It's actually quite warm, the water in the shallows,
yeah,
and quite soft.
It's only the soft surface of the water.
Now it's getting cold, yeah. Oh! Yeah, that was a bit of a slip up just then. But the water's, it's funny because everything looks yellow underneath it. It's the tannins in the water, right?
Yeah, so peat moss dyes it a little bit yellowish. So in the winter, we can see lots of yellow ice and it's absolutely normal.
Yeah.
It's not a funny yellow.
Okay, let's get down in the water then. 1, 2, 3, here we go. Oh, do you know what? It's horrible making yourself do it, but once you're sat in it, it's not too bad.
Actually, with the wind, it's colder outside.
Yeah, it's warmer to put your whole body in, but I'll tell you what, it feels exhilarating.
It is, and the adrenaline rush afterwards is better. So we usually do it from sauna, jump in the ponds or ice holes or in the snow. And the rush we get, it makes you want more.
It does, it's addictive. It's bath time, I'd definitely say the Estonian way.
Yeah.
After getting down and dirty in the bog, there was yet another Estonian indulgence to endure, an eco-spa.
I'm here with Tony in what was the first eco-spa in Estonia. What is the difference, Tony, between an eco-spa and a normal spa?
Spies, we are making everything here with natural ingredients. When I see the client, I see the skin condition and I'm making everything fresh and I'm not using any kind of chemical things. And as I told you before, like my grandmother told, if you're able to put this kind of thing inside your mouth, that means you are able to put that onto your skin. If you cannot eat, you cannot put this in your skin.
She sounds like a very sensible lady.
Tony slathered me with yogurt, berries, avocado. I have to say it reminded me of my breakfast buffet. But then it was time for the perfect end to my Estonia trip.
Tell me about the beer spa, because it sounds crazy.
But our life is crazy. I think you agree with that. But I think... it's also the first beer spa in Estonia, and generally, I know some people will say to me, oh, we are bad people, but I can say the natural beer is good for your skin because it consists a lot of E vitamins and etc. And in the meantime, you can just enjoy yourself, and beer have a lot of good things for your skin.
Yeah.
You don't must put too much inside. But have a bath with beer. It's good for your skin.
I can't wait to try it. Thank you very much, Tony.
Welcome back to Estonia.
As if I needed any more convincing.
Well, as Tony's gran would say, don't put outside your body what you're not prepared to put inside your body. And with that, I'm going to get into my own beer-infused hot tub and drink some local craft ale. Cheers, everyone.
From experiencing the beauty of bogs to bathing in beer, I think you'll agree that between Eveline, Helen and Tony, they managed to completely change my opinions of Estonia, from a place all about rowdy crowds to one that was a true natural wonder, whether experienced by boot or in a bath. That was me reporting from Estonia on a recent 4-day assignment. I don't mind admitting, I loved every single minute of it. One thing I don't love, however, is the necessary evil that always has to happen before a long trip. Packing. I don't know why. I mean, I do it all the time, yet I utterly despise it. In fact, if I was rich, I'd employ someone to do it for me. But for those of you like me who detest it, never fear. I have picked up a few tips and tricks over the years to make it a little less painful. So here is my travel hack of the month, how to pack like a pro. I'll set the scene for you. My flight leaves in just over an hour, the taxi driver is waiting outside, and I'm still pulling out clothes from the washing machine, calling out, "I'll be right there," and hoping it will dry in transit. I hate packing. But there are a few things I know do help. The first, make a list. Simple. Tick it off as you go and you won't forget any of the essentials. Number two, use packing cubes. These are the rectangular zip pouches that you can get to organise your stuff. I'll admit at first I was sceptical. What more stuff to worry about? But on my recent back-to-back trips, they proved a great way to organise my stuff into distinct sections. So underwear in one, because is it just me who loses clean knickers and then finds a heap in my bag once I get home? One for swim or sportswear,
another for toiletries. You get the idea. Number three, use the 1-2-3-4-5-6 rule for easy packing. So you use this if you're going for 1 week. So one hat, two pairs of shoes, three pairs of bottoms, i.e. pants or skirt, four tops, five pairs of socks and six pairs of underwear. It's a good quick way to work out just how much stuff you'll need when you're in a rush, and you can double it for a 2 week trip. If you need more than this, then you may be packing too much. Number four, go for multi-use items. So things that double up as more than one kind of outfit. So pick a jacket that you can wear while hiking and to warm up post-swim. Take a long skirt that you can dress up and make into something like a dress in the day, and then just a more casual skirt when you're walking around in the evening. A smart looking insect repelling shirt that looks formal and is practical for hiking and bug infested places too. Sure, my friends at Rohan could show you a few offerings. Number five, anti-smell clothing. Buy merino wool or synthetic fabric with polygene or other smell-busting treatments, and you only need one or two, saving room in your bag and removing the need for the dreaded wash on the road. Next tip is fold or roll. That's the age-old question. I like to fold into bundles, so types of clothes, one inside the other. Warm tops and walking kit all get folded as one bulk. Hot weather gear packaged up as another. It's amazing how little room it takes. Google it and you'll find lots of videos. Remember to use all the space in your bag. That's placing shoes inside of the grooves of the luggage case, putting socks or plugs into boots. Any space with nothing inside is simply wasted. And finally, don't leave it to the last minute. Okay, I'll never obey this one myself, but every time I promise myself I will. Best of luck, everyone. If you're anything like me, you're going to need it. That was my travel hack of the month, the insight I offer every episode to make your travels go that little bit smoother. Now, one thing that can make packing a bit of a problem is when you're doing multiple activities in the same trip, hot and cold, wet and dry. Well, that applies doubly when you join a liveaboard to undertake several days of snorkeling and diving on what is essentially a floating hotel. Last year, I did just that and learned a few tips on my way. I headed to the Maldives, on a trip to swim with the endangered manta rays that call the Indian Ocean home. But this was no ordinary liveaboard. This was one that was on a boat that belonged to the Manta Trust, a charity set up by biologist Dr. Guy Stevens, whereby guests' photos all can be added to the catalogue to record the species here, as every manta's underbelly has a unique pattern similar to a human fingerprint. I spoke to him to find out why he fell in love with the mantas, and why you should too.
A warning and an apology in advance. This was recorded at sea, and so the sound quality is not quite as crisp as I'd like, but you can still hear what he's saying.
The Manta Trust started in about 2010, is when I first sort of started to conceive the idea. It sort of grew out of research that I was doing here in the Maldives, trying to understand more about the local population. And then I started to realize these animals were threatened, and I thought there was a need for a sort of a global charity to address these problems. And that's how it started.
And what's the main threats that they face?
The main threats to manta rays are targeted fishing, so being being fished for their gills, which are used in Chinese medicine.
Okay, so being fished for Chinese medicine is one thing, and being caught in nets not on purpose as well, is that another?
Yeah, so the main threats, if you would sort of rank them in order of severity, would be certainly targeted, directed fisheries for their gill plates, fisheries for food, bycatch fisheries, so being caught as unintended victims in high seas purse seine fisheries, or caught in fishing line in places like the Maldives. So these are sort of secondary threats. And then a more sinister but probably more concerning longer term threat is climate change, which is reducing the availability of their prey, which may impact the ability of the population to reproduce and sustain themselves into the future.
And what's the aim of the Manta Trust then? What are you guys what you're hoping to achieve?
So we're a charity that's focused on trying to achieve a sustainable future for manta ray populations. We hope that we can protect the manta rays, protect the habitat, and we try and approach that with a sort of an aim of conducting research, also focusing on education and raising awareness, in which together hopefully we'll work from a top-down and bottom-up kind of approach.
And so you say in the Maldives, the educational side of it might be teaching locals about what? Would it be? Do you actively engage locals from each of the places around the world?
Yeah, so we have a Maldives education program underway, and I have a couple of staff, and they specifically are building a marine education program which brings in a lot of stuff with mantas. We're working with the Maldives Ministry of Education. So we go into the schools, we teach the kids all about the importance of marine conservation, also about the science, about the ecosystem ecology. And then part of that course is to take the kids out into the field as well. You know, they don't often have the ability to have a snorkel or a dive with a manta ray. So we'll actually take them out, give them that experience, and hopefully that will drive the next generation of marine biologists and conservationists in the Maldives.
And then what's your favourite bit about leading trips like this? Is it seeing people with their first encounters or what?
Yeah, I love these trips because they are, you know, I've been lucky enough to go all around the world and dive and snorkel and spend time in the water with manta rays and whale sharks and all these cool animals. But certainly when you can take people who have never seen these animals or never had these kind of encounters and see, you know, the look on their faces when they're experiencing these animals for the first time or in a way that they've never seen them before, that's definitely a big thrill. You know, it's nice to see other people feel the way I do about them.
And when we went into the water the other day, you know, there's obviously groups coming through now. Is that going to be detrimental? Or do you think that kind of is outweighed by the fact that getting people to sort of fall in love with them is worth the crowds?
Yeah, I mean, money talks. Whether it's exploitation for commercial gains through fisheries, or leveraging tourism as a way to protect these animals, I think you have to be pragmatic about the approach towards conservation. Certainly tourism is not perfect. You know, there's going to be impacts and you need to manage those impacts. You need to try and make tourism as sustainable as possible, and that's what we're trying to do. These animals are pretty tolerant. They are used to seeing people. They obviously there's a limit to how much they can tolerate, so you have to try and draw a line somewhere, and that's important. But overall, I think the balance at the moment is not too bad. We certainly see pressures at some sites where there's definitely a need to control the numbers of people. It just becomes too much, control the boats. But overall, it's better that we allow tourism as a way to generate revenue that incentivizes governments to do more to protect a species because of its economic value. And that's what usually wins the day, rather than just saying, hey, we need to protect these animals just because they're special and we think they're worth it.
And why should people care about the mantas?
Why should people care about the mantas? Why should people care about anything? You know, these animals have been here for millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, and I think every species has a right to exist, and I think we should care about every species, and we have a duty to look after the world in which we have a very large influence upon, and it would be a very sad place if, you know, my future, you know, offspring, relations, people weren't able to have the experiences that you and I have had this week on this trip.
And just describe how would you describe the experience that someone could have if they're seeing this and thinking, oh yeah, I might come, give it a go. What's it like? What do you experience?
It's like swimming with a flock of giant, you know, birds underwater. I mean, you literally are surrounded by these massive sort of 3.5 meter animals that will come within inches of you, that are perfectly harmless, very interested and engaged in humans as well. So they're often sort of wondering what you're doing in their environment. And so it's an experience that brings you closer to a wild animal that, unlike very few others. There's, you know, you couldn't go into the savannas of Africa and walk through a herd of elephants. You look at them from afar, from a safari vehicle. But in the Maldives, you can literally be amongst the herd of manta rays. We've yet to come up with a better name.
Cyclone
of mantas.
That was Guy Stevens, CEO and founder of the Manta Trust, who I'm pleased to say took my suggestion of the collective noun for mantas, a cyclone. Remember, if you're lucky enough to get out there, take lots of photos of the manta's undersides, which is as identifiable as a human fingerprint, and upload it to the Trust's database, because knowledge is power. Speaking of power, well, you're going to need plenty of it in your legs if you plan on undertaking a long-distance path. I am proudly president of the Long Distance Walkers Association in Britain, so you might say a Wonder Woman of all trades. And did you know that we have over 1,500 trails and paths covering more than 88,000 miles in the UK alone, all searchable on the LDWA website, that's ldwa.org.uk. Staggering. So if you fancy keeping it long, as we like to say, no Snickers please, then put your best foot forward and get ready to add some super walking trails to your wish list in this episode's Top 10. In at 10, the St. Olav's Way, Norway, an old pilgrimage route that's recently seen a resurgence. It runs from Oslo to Trondheim, spans 400 miles and will take about 4 weeks to walk. Expect to see expansive countryside with few visitors, old wooden churches, 13th century pilgrim hostels and rolling hills. In at 9, it's the base camp trek in Nepal to go and see Everest. If you've ever fallen under the spell of the lore of the highest mountain in the world, then this is the one for you. The distance is not that far, only 62 kilometres, which is around 40 miles, but the altitude is what gets you. Use a reputable company which allows plenty of time for acclimatisation. Coming in at 8, the Appalachian Trail USA. A long one. It stretches between the states of Georgia in the south and Maine in the north, which is a distance of over 2,000 miles, passing through 14 states in total. There's a whole load of trees. It's not called the Green Tunnel for nothing. And I recommend doing just a few sections. My favourite was Mount Washington in New Hampshire and parts of the Baxter State Park in Maine, as well as the first section to Springer Mountain in Georgia. Number 7, it has to be this one, the Camino de Santiago, Spain. Yes, it may be overdone, but there's something extremely enchanting about the Galician landscape in this northern part of Spain. Even doing just the last 100 kilometres qualifies you to be purged of your sins. I recommend, if doing this, starting in Samos, taking a week and arriving at the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela just in time for the Pilgrim's Mass and the swinging of the mighty Bota Fiumerio incense. In at 6, the Paparoa Track in New Zealand, brand new walk for the country. It only opens in December of 2019. I was lucky enough to do a preview hike of it and stayed in one of the huts in the mountains. It takes 3 days, includes lush subtropical forest, high ridges, stays in the remote huts, as I mentioned, and ends at the iconic pancake rocks of Punakaki. Go before everyone else finds it. In at 5, it's the Whale Watch Walk on Dirk Hartog Island in Western Australia. This island is doing a bold undertaking called the Return to 1616 Project. It's basically removing all invasive species and returning the island to a pre-European state. Between July and October, humpback whales migrate along its shores. So to take that in and views of the Indian Ocean, you can walk the 27-kilometre two-day hike, snorkelling and gawping at the marine life along the route. In at 4, the Kumokodu, Japan. This is a sister trail to the Camino de Santiago in Spain. It takes a 1,000-year-old pilgrim path, visits multiple shrines on every one of its four trails on the Ki Peninsula. It's reached by train from Kyoto, takes about 2 to 3 hours, and should take about 3 days to hike it. In at 3, the gorgeous W Trek in Chile and Patagonia. It's got wilderness. It's got forest, lakes, wild puma, a huge glacier, and the triple towers of the Torres del Peña you will have seen on many a postcard. There are no words. It's life-changing. Go and hike it. In at 2, a curveball, the Wanderlust Way, UK. Let's give a shout out to Grimsby, where you can do a 20-mile circular, enticingly called the Wanderlust Way.
You can even get a certificate afterwards commemorating your achievement. See it, and you'll realise it ain't so grim up north. And finally, in at one, I think one of the best long-distance pathways in the entire world. It's in Greenland, and it's called the Arctic Circle Trail. It's a hard one. Less than 300 people walk it every single year. It's just over 100 miles and stretches between the ice cap at Kangerlussuaq and the ocean city at Sisimiut. You will need stamina and all of your food and kit for at least an 8-day hike. But there's wild reindeer, Arctic hare, Arctic fox, and silence like nowhere else on Earth. Quite simply put, this was one of the best walks I have ever done in my life. Go do it. Wow. Just telling you all about those hikes makes me want to pack my rucksack, lace up my walking boots, and get outside. If you walk them, let me know what you think. Which have I missed? I want to hear all about them. Now, good gear can make the difference between a good walk and a great walk. This month, I've been testing something a little bit different, courtesy of my good friends at Rohan. This time, it's gloves that aren't actually gloves at all. Intrigued? I was. Welcome to my usual session of Complete Gear Geekery, presented in association with Rohan. This episode, I'm going to be talking gloves, because keeping our digits toasty is important. But if, like me, you suffer from cold hands, then mittens are obviously a great option, as they keep your fingers together, which generates more body heat. But what about if you want to actually use your hands to take photos, pitch a tent, post something on social? Well, then you're going to need something else. My something else were a great find that Rohan makes called the Weather System Gloves Convertible Mitt, £39. These are fingerless gloves, which are great for photography, but they have a magnetic captured foldback finger shield that transforms these fingerless gloves to mitts in seconds. They're also made from a warm, stretchy and durable polyester and super comfy right from the start. So when did they come into their own? Well, when I was in Estonia. It was sunny but cold. It was still going into spring and I wanted to take photos of birds and they move so fast. I was constantly adjusting my camera settings. Mittens would not have worked. But that's where these came in so handy because I could use them as fingerless gloves to do what I needed to. And then when I got cold, simply flip back the finger protector and suddenly I was warm again. Plus when I boiled the camping stove for tea, then when I set up the tripod, I could take off the finger shield and be back again with my fingerless gloves. Basically, they fit the bill and solved a problem and therefore come Wonder Woman approved. Thanks very much to my friends at Rohan for supporting Wonder Woman on her travels. Do check out their website, rohan.co.uk. And remember, Wonder Woman listeners get a 10% discount at the checkout by using the code WWN9. Now, someone who definitely still heads out in the kind of weather where you need gloves is my fellow wild sleeper, Robert McFarlane. Known for writing such wonderful nature masterpieces, including Mountains of the Mind, The Wild Places, The Old Ways, see, he likes a long-distance pathway too, and more recently, The Lost Words, I caught up with him at the launch of his latest tome, Underland, where this time he leaves the wide open spaces of the outdoors for the secret underground world beneath our feet.
You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast and I'm here with Robert McFarlane, who shares my love of sleeping in very strange places. Isn't that right, Rob?
Yes, it is true. I've slept in some strange places.
And I have to ask, where is probably the strangest place that you've ever slept?
That is a good question. I've slept underground. I think it's probably in the Parisian catacombs. So I spent two nights underground there, taken in by an amazing young person called Lena, which I should call her, which is a code name. And we entered the illegal sections of the catacomb labyrinth. And the labyrinth is full of these tight squeezes, which are absolutely terrifying. And then they open out into these old quarry rooms. And in those rooms you can sleep. And so we spent two and a half, nearly 3 days down, out of sight of sky and sun, and tucking into these, basically a stone coffin.
Wow.
is a strange place to be, and it reconfigures the way you think about space and time.
And so obviously I'm here with you for the launch of your book, Underland, and obviously I first was introduced to your work with Mountains of the Mind, which is obviously completely the opposite, the mirror opposite. And I find myself, I've got really into diving and seeing another sort of part of the world through under the water. Have you found it kind of mirrors it when you're looking at the underland, the underground part of our world?
Yeah, it is a mirroring. And I did start high, as it were, and now I've gone low. But I don't know how you find it with diving, but I think it's something different, actually. I think it's a stranger, darker, deeper place. It's much less rewarding in sort of classic aspects. I mean, climbing a mountain has just obvious pleasures to us culturally now, but going underground is something people don't tend to do. So I became interested in all the things that we don't look at, that we hide from ourselves, that we store for safekeeping. That's what the underworld holds. Diving, I don't know. What's it? That's pretty visionary, though, right? Being on a proper dive.
I think it's just, so I've done a lot of wreck diving now and night diving and really being exposed to that. I'd say it's almost the closest you can get to being in outer space.
Okay, well,
kind of floating in this otherworldliness.
Well, so there is a chapter called Starless Rivers, which is about the exploration of sunken rivers. So I descended 1,000 feet to the Timavo, which flows as fully as a river, not as groundwater, with rapids and currents, a big strong river way, way under the rock, and it flows like this for about 70 miles. This is up near Trieste, northeast Italy. And it was like going to another planet. Not deep space, but we dropped during the darkness and found myself in this chamber big enough to hold cathedral, filled with these dunes of black sand, and then we descended those in the darkness and found ourselves at the shore of this starless river. And yeah, I think there is an off-planet feel to the underworld as to the deep water.
And what was it that fascinated you, that took you from the mountaintops right down to this other world under the landscape that we all know so well?
Yeah, I mean, partly it's just a sheer kind of logic of gravity. I started high, and 15 years of writing has taken me lower and lower and lower. I kind of went to the forests and the valleys, and then the sunken paths in the old ways, holloways, which are the beginnings of tunnels. And then so there is a sort of geologic that's led me down. But I think the age that we are living in, the age of crisis, of environmental collapse, of extinction, of the Anthropocene, if we want to call it that, I think this is an age of darkness. We're living in dark times, and as Brecht says, in the dark times there will be singing of the dark times. And so darkness became to me very resonant of this strange, troubled, unsettled age that we're living through, when time isn't obeying the usual rules at all. And underland, the underland, is about time. It's about the ways we've told stories to ourselves about where we've come from and where we're going. So unexpectedly, the book became about something quite different to what I thought it would be. The Anthropocene took it over, as it were.
And you started many years ago. I remember when we first started talking and you were saying, I'm working on this book called Underland.
Yes.
Have you found it's taken this kind of dark turn in recent years, or has it? We've seen with the climate change activists, the young people, have you seen it actually brighten, as it were, with the underland?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've been working on this book for so long, and then it finally comes into the world. And as it happens, it surfaces a week after Extinction Rebellion, a week after David Attenborough's climate change documentary, in the season of the school strike spreading around the world. And these are finally people thinking about deep time responsibility, about the legacies that we are leaving, not just for the next generation, but for the generation after that and after that. And to me, to see contemporary politics suddenly reframed as a question of responsibility to generations as yet unborn is thrilling. It's really exciting, especially after the frantic short-termism of Brexit. And the question at the heart of Underland is, are we being good ancestors? Which is the question that Jonas Salk asks. And it's a question that, when you hear it for the first time, doesn't make sense. Then you ask it again of yourself, and it becomes this searching query: are we being good ancestors? And the answer is no at the moment. But just right now, there's a glimmer of brightness that suggests we might be learning how to become better ancestors.
And I think the thing with environmentalism and looking at ways we can change things is it can be quite almost depressing, that you think, God, we travel to learn about other cultures and to experience other people and to kind of broaden our mindset on what's going on, What would you say the one thing we can do as travellers to kind of still have that and still meet other people, but yet do it responsibly? Is there one thing we can do?
Well, I think I'd say two things to that. The first is that natural climate solutions, as they're increasingly being called, are thrillingly exciting. You know, we should be planting 1 billion new trees in this country by 2050. And that's going to be brilliant as long as we plant the right trees in the right places. So again, there's this sense that change can be change for the better. If we have 1 billion more trees, they'll be sucking down the carbon. Biodiversity will suddenly be on the rise again, up and down the across the insect and animal kingdoms. Our country will be a happier, healthier place. And second thing to say, which follows on from that, is that Britain is amazing. I mean, you and I have both written a lot about this. The first book, second book I ever wrote, The Wild Places, was really a hymn to the astonishing geographies of our country and the fact that actually, and there was a time when I was writing that when I thought, I don't need a passport.
Yeah.
Because you travel through a dozen different countries just by moving around this amazing island group of ours. So I would say, do you need to travel? There is what my dear friend, much missed friend Roger Deakin, the author of Waterlog, called the undiscovered country of the nearby.
And would you say, I guess, what would you say would be the ultimate, if you could only go in wild sleep somewhere else, but which is something that we both share, this love for spending time in the outdoors and sleeping somewhere wild. If you could only have one more wild sleep in your life, where would you go?
Summit of Swilven in northwest Scotland. Yeah.
And why?
Oh, well, it's a family mountain. My family has been going there for generations. My great-great-grandfather was the minister on the Stour Peninsula, so it has a lot of sentimental connection with that mountain. But also you look down on the world as upon a map from up there, and it is another planet from when viewed from the top of Swilven. And what that reminds you is what an astonishing place we live in.
We really do, don't we? We're very lucky.
We do. We have it all right here in these islands of ours.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Rob, for your time.
Thank you. It's lovely to talk with you.
That was Robert McFarlane and me chatting after rather a few wines in London. I'm surprised we made as much sense as we seem to. Clearly, wild sleeping makes you ever the professional. Well, we're nearly at the end of the episode, which means it's finally time for me to enlighten your hour, day, and even your entire year, I don't mind saying, with my Wonder Woman of the Month. I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe so you never miss an episode, and consider leaving a review. It really does help. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Phoebe R. Smith. Go to my website, phoebe-smith.com, where you can sign up for my monthly newsletter and get in touch with me. And of course, do check out my friends at rohan.co.uk, where you can enter the code I gave earlier at the checkout to get a discount off your entire order. Now, without further ado, here's the traveller who should be a household name, but few have heard of. Introducing my Wonder Woman of the Month. Tromsø, Norway. The year 1920. Here in this northerly coastal city, trappers bound for the Arctic archipelago of Svalbard arrive and depart daily, often headed to spend some of their earnings in the local Mac Brewery bar. When they come, taxi drivers swarm, hoping for business. But among the usual chances, one particular cabbie stands out. Her name is Wonnie Wolstad, the only female taxi driver in town. Widowed twice and mother of two teenage boys who she needs to support, she was already breaking established social norms by undertaking this perceived man's role in the city. But one day, picking up a man called Anders Sattadal, she was about to break another. Intrigued by the life this rugged trapper described up north, she began to dream of a life in the Arctic wilds. When she picked up more and more trappers, her curiosity piqued. And so when Anders offered her the chance to accompany him when she saw him next, she jumped at it. In 1930, she was bound north and about to make history at Huttavika in Hornsund as the first female trapper. Rather than become a standard housewife expected at the time, she instead threw herself into the role of trapper. She was already an accomplished markswoman and quickly learned how to trap and hunt in the Arctic conditions, accompanying Anders on most of his trips, and sometimes she headed out alone.
In their tiny three-roomed hut, she would run the home and often bring in two or three polar bears to thaw so she could skin them to sell their fur. A fancy existence this was not. She could wield a gun with the best of them, and she managed to take down seals, geese, ptarmigan, Arctic foxes, and even beluga whales, bringing significant profit to her and Anders. From 1933 to 35, she even took her teenage sons with her, and she set about training them in the art of trapping, which led them to becoming successful trappers in their own right. When the industry began to dry up in 1937, she left her life in the Arctic to head back to Tromsø, where she would entertain friends with her stories of life in the high Arctic, of hunting in the dark and building traps in an industry dominated by men. And though in her village she was a minor celebrity, no one outside of it really knows her name. She died in 1959, aged just 66, not from a run-in with a polar bear, as you might imagine, but when she was in her hometown walking, she sadly got hit by a truck. Trapping and hunting is of course controversial, and most of us, myself included, are relieved it no longer happens on the scale it used to. But that doesn't detract from this woman, who went against all social expectations to prove that anything a man could do, she could do equally as well, if not better, even in the extreme ends of the earth, which were considered, as many explorers put it, as no place for a lady. And that's why Wanni Wahlstedt is our Wonder Woman of the Month. That was Wanni Wahlstedt, one of our well-deserving Wonder Women of the Month. Now, in the next episode of the Wonder Woman podcast, follow me as I go hiking with an Aboriginal elder in Tasmania to experience the brand new Wukalina Walk, one of the few trails owned and operated by Aboriginal people in Australia. I also meet the man encouraging sex on the reef, of the coral kind, that is. I catch up with fellow Wonder Woman Keris Matthews to talk about her recent trip to Everest Base Camp and why she now can't get enough of walking gear, even when sitting down doing her radio show. I also bring you the best natural phenomena to catch around the world and tell you where to see it and when. I share my tips for getting the best deal on a flight and much, much more. See you then. Wonder Woman out. The Wonder Woman podcast is written and edited by me, Phoebe Smith. The producer for this episode is Daniel Nielsen. The wonderful logo was designed by John Summerton, and the photograph is by Claire Rodley. Thanks to our partner, Rohan. And a final thanks to all the people I met on my journey and were willing to talk to me. It's because of you that this podcast is able to happen at all.
Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer: Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook and audiobook.